Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, our Free Markets series. This week's guest, John A. Allison of North Carolina, a distinguished professor at the School of Business at Wake Forest University, could be speaking to us as a banker, a CEO, an entrepreneur. He's received numerous awards on all three counts, but he's here to do a book report, much as one of his students might do. He's here to talk about an author he admires enormously, Ayn Rand, author of many books, including Atlas Shrugged, a book which is enjoying a considerable renaissance across North America and the world today. He's here to tell us why and to communicate his profound belief in what Ayn Rand wrote, and maybe talk to us a little bit about the U.S. economy and where it went wrong. Here's Professor Allison. John Allison, it seems as if everybody and his brother or sister is reading Ayn Rand, and the name has been floating out there for a long time. She's not a recent author. What's she about, and why the sudden interest?
Well, Ayn Rand is immigrated from Russia. She was a victim of the Russian Revolution, really. Her family was, business was destroyed. She snuck over to the United States, and then she wrote a number of books, but two monumental, world-changing books, in my view, both The Fountainhead and The Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged was written in 1957. She wrote it, she said, for the purpose of her predictions not coming true. And unfortunately, her predictions are coming true, and that's why people are so interested in her ideas.
Prediction being that government takes over everything.
Right. The trend toward statism driven by philosophical beliefs that were anti-individualistic, and that those ideas would end up with a very statist society.
And it's funny how she ever got those ideas. I can understand the Russian Revolution. Like you say, her father, I think his business was taken over with the Russian Revolution. She came over at the age of 21, so the big scar there. But she was in Hollywood and so on, really left-leaning areas of the world, we can say that. And then she went through the 30s, which was a period of great union activity and so on in the U.S., she was all by her lonesome with these ideas, or
she,
not?
She absolutely was. She was totally out of sync with the world she lived in. But on the other hand, she understood how evil communism was. She had seen it in person, so she had a really strong commitment to present the ideas that underlie free society. And she studied philosophy. She studied Aristotle in particular, and history. And she grasped the implications of where we were going that a lot of people just didn't see.
And she wrote Atlas Shrugged, I guess, is the one that remains the most read. I believe it is the one that is now selling in its newer editions. That was written in 57. Now, those are the Eisenhower years. Again, a mystery to me. You would have thought that in those years, all this sort of leftist power, the stuff that was in fashion in the 30s, and people knew about Stalin by then. He died in 53. It seems to me she should have been happy with the way American society was going in 57.
Right? What she grasped is that ideas ultimately drive action. And she saw the new intellectuals at that time in the universities, the very left-wing intellectuals that showed up in the 1960s, as having ideas that would be very destructive. Rand is ultimately an advocate of what I'd call virtuous human action, that people need a sense of purpose, that reason is their means of survival, that they have to think effectively, and that they should try to achieve self-esteem through earning the right to feel good about yourself by having a productive, meaningful life. And she thought that individuals needed to do that in their own way, as free, independent human beings.
And I want you to tell me about this is not out of Ayn Rand, this is out of a speech you gave. I want to hear about the sandbox, because I want to get into this question of self-interest, but tell me about the sandbox.
All right. Well, one of Rand's fundamental ideas is people should pursue their rational self-interest properly understood. And it is in the context that most people believe that human beings are born bad. And the reason we're bad is we're selfish, and selfish is supposed to be bad. So you can see Johnny in the sandbox at 3 or 4 years old, having a good time, playing with his truck, not bothering anybody. Along comes Fred. Fred wants Johnny's truck. Johnny doesn't want to give it to him. Mom, dad, Sunday school teacher, kindergarten teacher gets involved into the discussion, the argument by now, and says, "Hey, Johnny, give your truck to Fred. Don't be selfish. Don't be bad." And there's two moral lessons being taught there. First, where did Fred get the moral right to the truck, right? That's where our welfare system comes from, right there, right in the sandbox. But more important, what about Johnny? What Johnny learned is that his life is secondary, that Fred's needs and desires are more important than his, that he fundamentally doesn't have the right to pursue his own happiness. And that is a very destructive idea. What Rand said is that we shouldn't try to take advantage of other people, but we shouldn't self-sacrifice either. Each of us has a moral right of our own lives, and what we ought to do is be traders, trade value for value, get better together. That life is really about creating win-win relationships, not sacrificing other people nor sacrificing ourselves. And that is the idea that underlies a free society.
But at the same time, I've noticed a lot of people who are objectivists or fans of Ayn Rand have been in their lives very generous. They have not hesitated to give of their wealth and so on. And so that's why I'm saying self-interest. There's a fine line here that there's the moralization of self-interest turns into selfishness, which is so-called bad. But nobody's denying that generosity is good.
Absolutely true. Rand basically said you had to hold the context, and this is what people do. Selfish is not about taking advantage of other people. In fact, that's self-defeating. Nor is it a kind of a linear, what I call a narcissist view of the world. It's holding the context and saying, what kind of world would I like to live in? And what would I enjoy doing helping create that kind of world? So for example, I support the United Way because I don't believe I would want to live in the kind of community that would exist if there wasn't a United Way, which is an umbrella charity organization, mm-hmm, and I wouldn't want my children to live there. I don't do it in a sacrificial manner, but I do it because it matters the quality of life that I have. So objectivism is not about being blind to other people. It's recognizing human relationships matter, but it's about not sacrificing for other people. It's about pursuing your rational self-interest, holding the context. That means having a sense of purpose, taking care of your body, taking care of your mind, and trying to create healthy human relationships. It's interesting. People say the world's bad because people are selfish. Here's the irony. Very few people really are selfish. Most mm-hmm. people don't have a sense of purpose. They don't take care of themselves, right? They don't work to create good relationships. What if everybody did that? What if everybody had a good sense of purpose, took care of their mind, took care of their body, worked to create healthy human relationships? Wow, wouldn't the world be better?
You know, and there's something else that I've often discussed with people who are fans of Ayn Rand is the notion sometimes there was a famous sentence, I forget who said it, that socialism had the best ideas but the worst practice. In other words, they say that it's going to be wonderful, but then when you look at the results, you're staring at the exact opposite. This idea of preaching to others, and Fred, when he takes the truck away, he's on the cusp of that. He's learning to be entitled, to feel entitled, and to preach to others. But isn't that that's human nature. It's going to be hard to get rid of that in any society.
Well, Rand's argument is that, no, we actually teach people to believe that. That as human beings, we're basically born a blank slate in terms of our ideas. We learn our ideas from our culture. And there have been times in history, like the early Americans didn't think that way, right? They were self-sufficient, personally responsible. That was a culture. We've taught people how to become dependent, how to become welfare recipients in a certain sense. And she actually mm-hmm. argues it's very destructive for the people that get the money, they lose part of their soul. That actually you get pride in yourself through your work, through taking mm-hmm. care of yourself, through personal responsibility, and you raise self-esteem that way. So there's a price to being dependent. But we teach people, would be her argument, to have those beliefs. They aren't natural. We're not naturally mm-hmm. that way.
And there are a lot of welfare states, not just the United States, that are beginning to rethink Canada, Germany, France. They're realizing that, first of all, it's a blank check. The right. bill just keeps going up and you can't pay it. But the transition back to something else, you talk about the early Americans, it was a simpler
right.
time.
True.
We can't deny that. How would we ever, in this modern complex world, how will we transition back to that if we are to do it?
She believes it's really about the ideas that we teach our children, and particularly the ideas we teach in our universities. That we didn't go, in America, from life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to the redistributive state by chance. Basically, left-wing ideas actually came out of Europe, took over our universities. We've taught our future leaders, like the current administration is an example, these ideas, and those ideas are really what describes human action. So what she's arguing we need to introduce new ideas that are old ideas. Uh-huh. Individual rights, free markets, personal responsibility, and make those the ideas that our leaders express, and that we select the kind of people that believe in those kind of concepts.
And how much pain will be involved in the transition? Let's say we get leaders who start, you know, all over the Western world to think and talk like that and say, okay, we've got to balance budgets. We're not going to have programs we can't afford. You know, all, the whole slew of it. There's got to be pain there. And there's got to be somebody somewhere less equipped to deal with it. Then what? Because that'll be on TV, right?
That's one of the challenges. Here in the United States, for example, we have a potential really serious financial problem. In 20, 25 years, the United States mathematically certainly goes broke. You run the numbers, we go broke.
And you're actually generous with 25 years.
Yeah, it may be shorter.
Yeah, it could at this rate,
So we have to do something. It's analogous, I think, to having a form of terminal cancer. Now, the good news, the cancer is treatable. But the bad news, it will be painful. And so there will be pain involved in it. But if we don't go through the pain, then we will die in a certain sense as a country. We will end up being a third world economy. So I think not everybody. I think the majority of people can be convinced of going through the pain if they understand the consequences and they understand that in the long term, our children and grandchildren will be dramatically better off. If you think about it, what we're doing to our children and grandchildren is immoral. And I don't think many people really want to do that. If you ask me, would I like to set up the kind of world where my grandchildren are going to face serious economic problems versus sacrificing today? I'll sacrifice today in a heartbeat. Not because I don't care about my own life, but I do feel a certain kind of love for my children and my grandchildren that's important to me. And I don't want to be responsible for not giving them a good chance to be happy.
And what happens, because again, I'm thinking in media terms because that's my business, that's my industry.
Right.
What happens when the pain becomes dramatic and, you know, for instance, when a city goes bankrupt and there's no, you know, the sewer service and all those things just cannot function, we might say, well, that's, that, you know, they asked for it, it's time to, but meanwhile, the toilet's overflowing. I mean, when it gets very nitty gritty, is a little bit of gas in the car allowed or not?
Well, here's what I think. If we actually allocated our resources rationally, we could certainly have good sewage. If you look at the amount of money we spend on things that don't need to be done, it's pretty stunning.
Yes, correct. Absolutely correct.
And a lot of our challenge is forward commitments that we've made. We've got an out-of-control cost in Medicare, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is move back to a private medical system. Look at food. Food's more important than medicine. If you don't have any food, you die before you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, food costs as a percentage of our budget has been in a free fall. And yet we have basically very limited interference in the food market by the government. It's the government's interference in the medical market that's created an incredibly inefficient system, or in case of countries like Canada where there's a huge rationing of health care that leads to really big problems long term. And what we need to do is privatize medicine. It needs to be a 20-year program because we didn't get here in 2 weeks.
That's right, yeah.
But that's
what I'm wondering.
The discipline of the market, there would almost, this is an interesting thing. Printing money to spend on things you don't need to do, which is what we've been doing, is not going to raise your standard of living. You know that at home, right? And
yes,
I think the immediate, as soon as business people grasped that the United States was having discipline, that we weren't going to go broke, they would be more optimistic and they'd be more willing to make investments and we could drive a faster growth rate. Because the real mathematical solution for our problems is dramatically improving the economic growth rate. And that depends on people's confidence that they're going to be able to innovate, be creative, be free, not be overregulated, not be overtaxed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we had the right picture of the future, while there'd be some pain in the short term, people could grasp that picture and see how much better they and their grandchildren would be better off. And I think then the pain would be a lot less dramatic. And we're still a wealthy society, so we can take care of the toilets and things like that.
So there would be a little bit of Band-Aid or whatever you want to call it, some kind of social engineering to kind of mop up the worst messes and...
Well, the social engineering to me was we could eliminate 9 out of 10 regulations. Regulatory costs in the United States exceeds taxes. And I know in the banking business, if you ask me what would I rather do, I'd say get rid of regulations. So, and 95% of these regulations are actually destructive instead of productive. You could free up huge amounts of human resources in very short periods of time. So Yeah, you need a mandate, but I don't think you need social engineering. What I think you need is a free society and a free market.
And I was thinking of Ayn Rand, who loved clear and, you know, clear and, well, as Reagan used to say, the things may not be easy, but they can be simple.
Right.
I didn't say it exactly like that, but it came to that. I was thinking that she might have turned her guns from government if she'd been around in the past couple of years to Wall Street. Am I correct? And she might have blasted them.
Well, she blasted what I call crony capitalism. Well, she pointed out that many business people were actually the worst kind of socialists and statists, and that they wanted a free lunch from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be highly critical of crony capitalists. And clearly, we've seen a lot of that. People that get favors from the government get bailed out when they shouldn't get bailed out. And she always was adamantly opposed to that. But she did point out, you know, in the United States, we have separation of church and state. She said, well, look, the reason we have crony capitalists is because the government can dole out favors. If we really had a limited government and they couldn't go out favors to Wall Street, there wouldn't be any benefit to being a crony capitalist.
But you could have crooks on Wall Street, inventing all kinds of funds and so on and derivatives. I mean, I think she would have wanted to punish them as well because they brought the whole thing down.
Well, now we're getting into. Yes, there were crooks on Wall Street, but in my view, I was a banker, remember, 20 years.
Yes, I know.
In my view, they played a trivial role. The cause of the financial crisis in the United States was primarily the Federal Reserve printed too much money trying to avoid a correction because Greenspan wanted, the head of the Federal Reserve wanted never to have bad times.
Mm-hmm.
That bubble, massive, too much money, went into the housing market because of affordable housing policies imposed by the federal government through Freddie and Fannie.
And Fannie Mae, yeah.
And so, yes, Wall Street played a role, and I would have let those guys fail, and I'd put the crooks in jail. But they were very secondary to government policy. The government was trying to drive home ownership above the natural market rate. They've been working on it for years, and they set up a disaster by subsidizing and encouraging people to buy houses that they couldn't afford. And for banks, we were under an intense pressure to do high-risk home loans to meet this affordable housing
goal. And to your credit, because you were a banker, and we can talk about that, yours refused to do that.
We
all
did.
All the way, not just at the last minute.
We did. And in our case, it was a matter of principle. And this really came from Rand, that we believe that we should act in principle. One of the commitments in our mission, one of our purposes, is to help our clients be economically successful and financially secure. And one thing I've told our employees many times over the years, never, ever do anything that you know will be bad for your client. Even if you make a profit in the short term, because it'll always come back to haunt you in the long term. And if you do the right things for your client, you'll be successful in the long term. We knew these kinds of loans, particularly what they called negative amortization loans.
Where you're paying nothing, really.
Right, you're paying less than the interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Was a disaster for young people. So we said, we're not going to do this ethically, because we think it's the wrong thing to do. At the time, we made less money, and we were criticized for not doing it. But I knew that I didn't want to look some young guy in the eye 5 years after we'd set him down a path that we knew was going to be a disaster.
His house. Yeah.
And so we didn't do it over ethics.
But the people doing that the way you did it were pretty rare at the time.
True.
And as you
True.
Say, you were criticized. People mock you and say you were passing up good business opportunities?
Sure. I don't know if they mock, but they criticized and said, and our stock price was good, but it wasn't as good as it could have been in the short term. It's a lot better now than the people that did it. But I would say this, there was a huge amount of governmental pressure to do those loans. I mean, it wasn't that people just did them all voluntarily to make a profit. There was a lot of government pressure to do affordable housing.
And the irony, and this is a central irony, and it comes up in the research on you, you had to take TARP funds, $3 billion, I think it was, Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Yeah.
You had to take it, and you were happy to pay it back with the interest as quickly as you could. But why did you have to take it?
No, that's a really sad story. I was adamantly opposed to TARP. I was the only CEO of a large financial institution in the U.S. that wrote Congress. I did everything I could to stop TARP because I thought it was going to be a long-term disaster, and I still think it's going to be because I think we were keeping in business firms that should fail, and I think that's bad for the economy in the long term. Anyway, after TARP passed, I got an interesting call from our regulator, and they said this very obliquely because regulators do this, but basically this is the essence of what they said. They said, John, you know, BB&T has way more capital than you need based on the regulatory standards we've had for 25 years. However, we've decided to change the capital standards. We don't know what the new capital standards are going to be, but we're confident if you don't take TARP, you won't have enough capital. And we have an audit team coming in the next couple of days to see that unless you take TARP.
But if you had more capital, were they saying that they were going to change them in such a severe way? Then nobody could have survived.
Or apply it differently to us. And here's the reason for that. And remember, we don't have rule of law. We have rule of regulators. Regulators make up the law any way they want to. Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, is a student of the Depression. And during the Depression, individual banks got help from the government, but it didn't work because the market jumped up. What Bernanke realized were three large financial institutions getting ready to fail. He thought that if he just helped those companies, the market wouldn't work. So he tried to force all the large banks, all the $100 billion and over banks, to participate, including all the healthy banks, because then it would obscure the banks that were being bailed out. And he really used the excuse that he was trying to motivate banks to make loans.
So that phone call was really muscle.
It was, of course. That happens all the time. It's always, they say it very carefully, but you get the message, right?
Because they could have put you out of business, but since they regulate you, they could have said you're not a bank anymore.
Just like that. Or what they typically do is stop you from opening any branches, keep you from doing any mergers, basically tie your hands behind your back.
So you took excess capital you didn't need.
Right.
And what do? You just stared at it?
Lost money on it. And the fact that we didn't need it became self-evident. You may remember after this process, they did a test to be sure you had enough capital. We had way more capital than we needed. So it cost BB&T $50, $100 million in expenses for money we didn't need. BB&T never had a loss in the quarterly loss. So we couldn't possibly have needed the capital, which is mathematically impossible in this process.
But could you have used it as equity to buy up other banks or something? You could have done something, no?
Well, but you knew you had to pay it back sometime. And it was a huge price. The TARP agreement was an amazing agreement. It had this 10,000 things we had to do. And then at the end of the agreement, it says the government can change any of the rules anytime it wants to, including employment contracts and retirement contracts with executives.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. That's
not an agreement, right? Mm-hmm. Would you enter into an agreement where the other party can change it any way they want to, anytime they want to? Of course not.
And so you just stared at that money, basically, and waited till you... You couldn't pay it back right away. You couldn't pay it back the next day.
Couldn't pay it back till they went through the so-called stress test and you had enough capital and made all those rules. We were technically the first bank to pay it back, although we beat the other guys by a few minutes. But there was a group of us, and we were the first bank to pay it back.
And to get back to Ayn Rand, I'm just wondering, first, did you ever meet her? She didn't. She lived to be quite old.
No, unfortunately, I never did.
I'm told she was chain-smoking and very talkative and short, feisty type of woman. Sometimes when you study great chefs, you wonder what they have in their fridge at home. Do we know anything about how she handled her own business affairs or her own business life?
Yeah, I happen to be a friend of her intellectual successor, a guy, Leonard Peterkoff, who's a genius, in my opinion, and he's talked to me a lot about Rand. She was a very gracious person. She had a strong accent, so people see her as a lot tougher than she was. I mean, it was a communication issue. You look at her personal relationship, she was a very demanding person, as you can expect, but she was also a very human person. And she basically lived consistent with her beliefs. She acted.
Did she ever go into business, or?
No. But she made a lot of money selling her books, and that was her business.
Yes,
she was an author.
Yeah.
That was her money.
That's true.
But one of the interesting things, Atlas Shrugged, there was a lot of effort to turn it into a movie, and I really wish it had happened, but she wouldn't let it be turned into a movie without her having editorial control, because she was afraid people would distort the ideas in her movie. So she felt so strongly about her beliefs that she was willing to sacrifice a lot of money, she was living well, but she was willing to sacrifice a lot of money to be sure she lived consistent with her philosophy, with her ideas.
And, of course, Atlas Shrugs, because the world is getting too heavy to bear. Do you see that in the future? How bad can it get from where you're sitting before it gets better?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the theme of Atlas Shrugged is, what if the men of the mind go on strike? What if the productive business people, the scientists, the engineers, the thoughtful people go on strike? And of course, the consequences are a disaster. And to some degree, that's what's happening now. The pressure of government regulations, the pressure of taxation, are making highly productive people less willing to be productive. They may not just quit, but they don't. They invest less, they take less risks, they're less motivated. And unfortunately, I think that is going on. Now, I'm not in the pessimist. I think we can turn this around. Mm-hmm. I do believe that ideas drive action, and I believe that the ideas of the left are being exposed as they won't work. I mean, our societies, and any socialist-type society, is having severe financial problems. There is no free lunch at the end of the day, and I think a lot of people get that. And I'm optimistic we can change those ideas, not without pain, not without some struggle, but I think we can turn them around. But I think we need to do it in the next 10 years, because if we don't do it relatively soon, it does become a mathematical disaster from an economic perspective. And then you have social problems.
Well, John Allison, I'm sure you take solace from the fact that her books are selling, so somebody out there is listening.
I absolutely do. In fact, her sales are at all-time high. And this is a philosophical novel that's over 1,000 pages. But we have a program on universities that encourages students to read Atlas Shrugged. And we have 25,000 students that go through these programs. And I've had thousands of those students tell me that Atlas Shrugged changed their whole worldview, that it is the most powerful book they've ever read, that they were inspired by it. For those people that believe in free societies, I think it's particularly important because it is the only novel that shows business people as heroes, that can inspire young people and motivate them and can give them the energy to fight some of the challenges. So I recommend to anybody that's interested in ideas and wants to get excited to read Atlas Shrugged. It's a fun read, too. It's a great book.
Yeah, it's got incredible characters.
It really is, right? The greatest, I think, heroine of all time in Dagny Taggart.
All righty. Well, I think you sold a few books right now.
So I hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Val.
Professor John A. Allison of Wake Forest University in North Carolina was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of The World Show. And that's our program for this week. I'm Bob Scully.